Ever feel like you're too busy to eat healthy? Meal kits from Sunbasket are the perfect solution. My family loved the recipes they sent over. This week, you could try out the Green Goddess Chicken Salad Lettuce Wraps with roasted almonds, or the Black Angus Steak with balsamic glazed radishes and Brussels sprouts, or feel free to choose from their seemingly limitless options. Everything is pre-measured, pre-portioned, and easy to prepare. Plus, Sunbasket meals are dietitian approved, so you can feel confident that you're putting a healthy and delicious meal on the table. Sunbasket is proud to work with the best farms and suppliers to fill their meal kits with organic fresh produce and responsibly sourced antibiotic-free meats and seafood. No matter your lifestyle, Sunbasket caters to your kind of healthy. It's easy to customize recipes to meet your exact needs. If you want to swap red meat for chicken or turkey, or swap in a vegan protein, they are completely flexible. Go to sunbasket.com/mindful today to save $120 across your first four deliveries. That's sunbasket.com/mindful to save $120 across your first four deliveries, plus free shipping on your first order.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the reproductive rights amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported Issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.
Dr. Russo, thanks for joining me for round two on the Mindful Movement podcast, man.
Great to be back. Yeah, thank you for having me.
You were one of our early guests when we were just getting started, and I was so grateful that you came on because we didn't really have anything established yet, and it was really nice. I remember it was kind of a rush conversation. You were late getting to it, but it was really important to me. And since then, I have, I think, given your book and your podcast out to so many people, especially my clients in the gym environment. And it's had such an impact on so many people, man. I really appreciate it. I will forever be grateful for the work that you've put in and the work you continue to do to put it out there. Because I see firsthand it helping people, and it's really nice.
Well, thank you. You know, I had my own gut health issues, and so that was an unpleasant experience. But in suffering through that, you figure out some important things that people need to be aware of, and tools, and how we can modulate the microbiome and the diet and the supplements and the mindset, like we were talking about before. And when you get all those things right, people can go from brain fog, insomnia, bloating, loose bowels, to feeling great and having good energy and focus and no bloating and not being concerned about having to run to the bathroom. And it really just changes your life. It changed my life first, right? And so then being able to share with other people and hearing testimonials like yours or feedback, it makes the stretches where the work is challenging and tough trying to build something that can help people, because it's not always easy, right? There's a lot of headwinds that you have to surmount, makes that hard work worth it. So thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. From the wound comes the gift. That's like a common theme I find myself realizing in this podcast through these interviews, and, you know, to hear you go through your own story. And it sounds like you continue to question and tinker and fail and succeed with your own journey. And I like, I find that stuff inspiring. And, you know, as soon as someone, especially with a label of doctor, you know, pretends they know things, it's like knowledge is the biggest obstacle to understanding. And you stay curious, and it is much appreciated. In fact, one of my clients who's a physician that I put onto your work is like on the verge of abandoning her Western medicine position and like switching over to the functional medicine route because she, I think, is frustrated with not being able to help the people in front of her, because I guess maybe just being handcuffed by the scaffolding of that system, not so much like she's learning more tools, but can't deploy them in a reasonable way within that framework. But you have said one thing that has stood out to me that I've really appreciated that you present is just a simpler way to start trying things without getting caught up in, I think, some of the pitfalls of of going to doctors, especially in the alternative medicine world where there's definitely could be over-testing, which could be really stressful for people that aren't feeling well, especially they might have already spent a lot of money trying to fix things and hitting a lot of dead ends. And one thing that I've always wondered when I see a test is, would the answer of this test even change my approach? Like if the issue I have here is a function somehow of not being healthy, am I just better off trying to get healthier?
Yeah, well, thank you. It's a super important question. And I think kind of coming back to your client, friend, colleague in conventional medicine, when you leave that system with all the confines like you described, right? Like, oh gosh, Medicare won't even cover like a vitamin D in some cases. Because I used to do insurance billing in the office and it was just such a fight sometimes for even the most basic blood work, like a ferritin would come back. And then, you know, there's this whole thing of, oh, yeah, the insurance company marks that up. It's a ridiculous markup. So you have to resubmit, fill out the paperwork again. It oftentimes gets re-denied. So that whole scenario stinks. When you finally leave that model and you can test as a clinician whatever you want, it's very easy to just kind of check off every box, so to speak. The thing that I don't feel is adequately discussed in the space is that most, not all, but I would say most, the vast majority of tests in the functional space are theoretical. And you know, we look at more traditional tests like blood pressure, blood sugar, cholesterol, thyroid hormones, let's say, that have much more well-agreed upon ranges. This includes thyroid hormone, even though that's sometimes contentious. I think you know this is what we've published a few papers on to date and we're continuing to research. But nevertheless, there are a lot of more traditional markers that have very well-defined normal ranges and what's known as predictive value, to your point, which we know that if you have this imbalance, there's a high likelihood that the corresponding treatment's going to help you. What ends up happening is that same assumption is carried over into the litany of functional medicine tests that haven't been established or studied to have that data. And it can be really sobering when someone says, well, I was tested for X, I treated X, and I feel no better. That happens a lot. That happens a lot more than you would think. And it's because many of these tests are still in the theory mode, where we don't actually know how much that correlates with disease or if it predicts if a certain treatment is going to be helpful. So the argument I've been making is if many of these tests, like a gut microbiome analysis, let's say, isn't definitively going to change how you treat someone, use their symptoms and their history and maybe prior supplements or treatments or diets they've tried, all is clues that are going to be much more accurate inferences to predict what they're going to respond to. And there's some really simple things, like if you're trying to figure out if someone has a bacterial overgrowth or a fungal overgrowth, you could test. To do that accurately, you're looking at a little over $1,000, mainly because fungus you have to try to quantify via blood, via urine, and via stool. Or you could just look at, well, do vegetables tend to bloat you? Or do you not do well with sugar, starches, and high-carb foods? That right there is probably the most predictive of, is this someone bacterial overgrowth and therefore prebiotic and fiber intolerant, or are they fungal overgrowth and therefore starch, sugar intolerant?
Interesting. Can we dive right into that? Because I find that to be very interesting. I mean, I've heard the whole, I guess, SIBO, CIFO. So for the listeners, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, having too much bacteria where I guess it ought not be in the small intestines, or too much fungal overgrowth. There's always going to be bacteria and fungus throughout the whole GI, I guess, but you just don't want too much in the areas that they're not supposed to be. So in that case, like if you don't feel well and you don't want to do a bunch of testing, let's say you have GI issues and you have this real low-hanging fruit of like the low FODMAP diet, which is essentially a reduction of fermentable fibers, which seems to do a lot of good for a lot of people that I have talked to, and including myself, which is it's too powerful to deny the value in just trying that first, just to see before you do testing. But you're saying that if it's a more fungal-related overgrowth, that that should, in theory, be less effective as opposed to just reducing the more easily digestible non-fermentable sugars?
Yeah, in essence, because it's all about what substrate, what foodstuff feeds whatever population that we're trying to normalize. We know that bacteria feed on what we oftentimes stereotype as healthy foods, right? The prebiotic, the fermentable fibers, like you were saying, asparagus, cauliflower, as a couple examples, broccoli, garlic, onions. I'm not saying they're unhealthy, but if someone does have a pre-existing bacterial overgrowth, those foods feed the bacteria and can make that imbalance worse. But conversely, fungus don't feed on those. Fungus feed on things like rices and potatoes and starches. And so it's a bifurcation that we've been looking at, trying to help determine, is this person's gut more skewed toward fungal overgrowth or more skewed toward bacterial overgrowth? And Satish Rao, who's a gastroenterologist at University of Augusta, did publish a survey essentially on this. So I think it was about 200 patients with unexplained GI symptoms. And about 20% had bacterial overgrowth and about 20% had fungal overgrowth. So this can be really helpful just in looking at someone's history, coming back to the need to, I think, better listen to the patient and not be so reliant on testing. If you probe into their diet, people will often say, oh, well, you know, carbs don't agree with me. But that's very broad. Do you mean salads don't agree with you? Do you mean rices don't agree with you? Because you'll see more classically, if it's bacterial overgrowth, people will say, oh, like a salad will bloat me, vegetables will bloat me, but white rice sits really well. That's bacterial overgrowth type. Conversely, some people will say, man, when I go keto or lower carb or sort of like a meat-based paleo and I keep the carbs low, the protein and vegetables high, I do awesome. That's more so fungal overgrowth because they're reducing starches and sugary fruits.
So what is it? So the bacteria are eating these fermentable aspects of the carbohydrate, but the fungal stuff is eating the glucose itself?
The starches and the sugars, exactly.
But so this is where I struggle with this a little bit, because I feel like I've dealt with some fungal overgrowth stuff. It's like the same fuel that they're feeding on is also like our cells' favorite fuel, it seems.
Well, I mean, it's a great question, right? And this is where, you know, again, I think it fits into this model of, if we're trying to test for all of this, people are so complex that if we're trying to test every biochemical pathway, it is just debilitatingly confusing. But what we could do is just have someone trial low FODMAP versus a candida diet and see which one they feel better on. Because that's going to give us the net, right? Because there might be a little bit of bacterial overgrowth and a little bit of fungal overgrowth. In fact, in that same study by Rao, he found another 20% had both. Yeah, but it does seem, at least in my clinical observation thus far, that people tend to lean one way or the other in terms of they do better lower carb candida or they do better lower FODMAP. And so rather than trying to test all of this, because even with the best, even if you had $1 million, right, and you wanted to quantify down to the umpteenth, I would argue you still wouldn't know what diet is going to be better for someone until you just try it. And the beauty of that is you can tell usually within a week or two, someone's going to know, I'm less bloated. I have better mental clarity. My bowels are better. So it's so powerful because the intervention, when you look at the impact of said intervention, it's going to give you the net summary of all the different ways a diet impacts somebody. And that's what we're after, right? We're after what is the net most beneficial for the individual.
I have one specific question about a food product. When dealing with SIBO, when you look at the chart of like FODMAP, dairy's on there because of the lactose in it. Have you found in the clinical setting that lactose-free dairy products could play a big role for people where that's the difference of them really being able to get in that, you know, source of nutrition without having their symptom flare up?
Yes. Generally, I find that dairy tolerance is able to be recovered. One of the important concepts, so yes, regarding lactose, but there's a level beyond this, which is the villi, the microvilli, the intestinal border secretes lactase, the lactose digesting enzyme. When there's inflammation and irritation in the gut, or said another way, when you have symptoms, there's probably inflammation and irritation underlying that. You don't have as robust of a release of those enzymes. So as the gut gets healthier, the ability to release those enzymes, therefore digest those carbohydrates, lactose, improves. And this isn't just theory. There have been meta-analyses of clinical trials showing, for example, using a probiotic supplement intervention can increase lactose tolerance. So this is the beauty of what I do and what we do at the clinic, is people will come in so well-educated, so well-read on various diets, but oftentimes really restrictive because they're missing other factors than just the diet. In Healthy Gut, Healthy You, I said don't force a dietary solution to what might not be a dietary problem. So certainly diet and lifestyle is foundational, right? But if there is a bacterial or fungal overgrowth or something else, if we remedy that and heal the gut, then their tolerances should start to improve and they can broaden their diet.
For sure. And I've personally experienced that where the healthier I got, just the more food I could handle, the more like off track, the more like bad decisions I could tolerate too when like out at a restaurant or whatever, where you don't have to feel like you can't be, you know, part of the tribe if there's like a social event or something. Yeah.
There's a delicate balance between being a health educator on the one hand and helping people have awareness of how FODMAPs might not be healthy for a gut or how excessive carbohydrate may not be healthy for a gut. But we always try to contextualize that as this is a rehab plan. Like you hurt your back and okay, so you can't sprint or squat heavy right after that back injury. But 2 or 3 months later, you should be able to go back to those movements once you've healed. That same perspective should be, in my view, the expectation the clinician sets on day one when we start using a restrictive diet. This is going to heal, and then you can expand. But what I've witnessed an alarming amount is the health educators, maybe it's inadvertent, maybe it's intentional, but they're not looping that closing thought in, which is, you know, these foods might be bad. As you heal, your tolerance improves. You know, oftentimes it's the people who wrote a book on why XYZ food is bad. They do the podcast circuit and you kind of just get that step one of awareness of why these foods are bad. But if we don't close that loop, you end up in a situation. And Sarah Ballantyne was on the podcast recently and she cited something along the lines of, I think it's as much as 30% of people who go on elimination diets develop some sort of eating disorder. So, yeah, I think it's really important to your point to be able to make some bad decisions. And that bad decision might be a glass of wine and a slice of bread. And I would argue that's not a bad decision. If you're healthy, you should be able to do those things. You know, it's not about living like a monk. You know, you want to do the healthy things most of the time, but then be able to enjoy indulgences.
Yeah, you could definitely get trapped. I want to parlay into a more overarching idea here. So you mentioned lactase. I've been learning more about metabolism, like in general, over the last couple of years, and how it like governs so much and so much of like the GI system as a whole. And one thing that I learned is that a proper functioning thyroid or proper, you know, functioning metabolism is required to make lactase and all kinds of enzymes. And it makes me wonder, like, I don't know if it's a chicken or the egg thing. Like, you have all these, I definitely see there's all these people with reduced metabolism and they have a lot of symptoms associated with that. And there's all these people that have GI issues like the gas and the bloating and such, things that would indicate some type of overgrowth. And I wonder, in theory, metabolism as a whole is, I mean, you could make a case that it's higher upstream, but you could also make a case that if you have an overgrowth, it suppresses metabolism. So, like, at what point, how do you know if it's worth trying to, I don't want to say micromanage, or is trying to address SIBO or CFO downstream, where is if you supported the metabolism, that your body's own like healing abilities and all the stuff it can do to make sure there isn't overgrowth in it would be able to function optimally?
Yeah, this is a good question. It's challenging because metabolism is very broad. So I would look at metabolism with kind of a few subsets, if you will. Metabolism can be influenced by thyroid hormone function, certainly. So we'll start there really quick. When someone is overtly hypothyroid, then yes, that can manifest as issues with their gastrointestinal tract, because thyroid hormone in part helps govern metabolic rate of all the cells, including the gastrointestinal cells, right? So this is why constipation and frank hypothyroidism go together. So if we're defining metabolism in one frame as true hypothyroidism, then yes, that needs to be addressed, and that might actually be the source of some of the gastrointestinal symptoms.
How are you defining that, the true hypothyroidism? Is that...
Yeah, and this is key, because right? There was a meta-analysis published in 2018 in the journal Thyroid that found 37.2% of people were incorrectly diagnosed as hypothyroid. That's 1 in 3. That's huge. Yeah, so this is like the question, the answer, and the argument, right? So there's a couple reasons why we find ourselves where 1 in 3 people, according to this meta-analysis, the best data point that we have, right? And the importance of a meta-analysis, just really quick, is it's not one study that might not be representative of the entire body of literature. It's so, so important in areas of contention, because one of the things I've seen and that's deeply troubling is clinicians, gurus, whoever, health educators, instead of like going to a body of literature and studying it to learn, they just look for whatever enforces their preconceived notions, and then that's the data point that they share. So everyone's making a scientific case because they're citing a study. But if your study is 5% of the database and actually 95% of the database suggests something else, it's really problematic. So this happens in thyroid, wherein the functional and integrative medical community has had this theory that the conventional medical ranges for thyroid lab markers is too broad and they should be narrower. Okay, that's hypothesis. That's from maybe 15-ish years ago. But there have been numerous clinical trials that have actually verified that the conventional medical ranges for TSH and free T4 are actually correct. So this is one area where I think conventional medicine has it right. And I don't care if it's conventional or alternative. I care about who's closer to the truth. And in some cases, one camp is, in some cases, the other camp is. TSH, so the cutoff, according to Quest or LabCorp, for TSH is about 4.5. And for someone to benefit from thyroid hormone, for someone to be truly hypothyroid, the TSH usually has to be above somewhere around 7 to 10. What ends up happening is people will go to their doctor, and again, remembering that cutoff is 4.5, you know, the lab says you shouldn't be above 4.5, which is true, right? But someone might be 4.1, they might be 5.2, right in the area of the cutoff, and their doctor says, oh, you're hypothyroid, take medication.
But is TSH even a marker of hypothyroid?
Yes. Now, the other part of this argument that gets confusing is there's many people saying that you need the full panel where you look at T3, reverse T3. Those are not markers of thyroid function. Those are markers of metabolism of thyroid hormone. So they do tell you something. They tell you, are you under eating? Are you too low carb? Are you high stress? Are you not sleeping enough? Because when those factors are present, the metabolism of the thyroid hormone gets skewed. But that's actually your body in a protective way, trying to sort of slow you down because you can't cope with the stress, with the poor sleep, with the low carb, right? And one example is when people go on low calorie diets, they'll lose weight and they'll lose fat, but they'll also see their thyroid hormone metabolites change because the body's trying to conserve energy. So the problem is people will be diagnosed, air quotes here, as hypothyroid based upon the downstream metabolites. And that's not correct. That's not how you diagnose hypothyroid. The TSH, free T4.
But isn't T3 like that primary active thyroid hormone? Like, why wouldn't we want to use, if broadly it's like, okay, thyroid is there to regulate this metabolism, to modulate it. And ultimately metabolism is like taking food stuff and making a bunch of energy so that we could do all the things. What's the best reflection of, are you making lots of energy from the food you eat? Like, does TSH or T4 speak to that more broad question of, Is my body doing the things?
Well, there's two questions here that often get conflated. One is your thyroid gland producing adequate hormone, right? Is your gland broken or damaged? That's hypothyroidism. The other is, how healthy is the metabolism of that hormone? It's just like with a man or a woman, they might make estrogen and testosterone, but a woman might convert too much estrogen into testosterone and therefore have facial hair and acne. Or a man might convert too much testosterone into estrogen and have gynecomastia or be emotional. So there's two questions you're looking at there. Are the ovaries or the gonads making hormone? That's one. And then the other is there something happening to that hormone once it's been made that's skewing its metabolism? And that's where things like inflammation and stress can skew metabolism of all hormones. So when we separate, we're looking at thyroid gland function versus metabolism of thyroid hormone. If it's a metabolism issue, it's all the stuff that you probably talk about, which is stress, mindfulness, exercise, adequate carbs, adequate calories, right? All those things. So the challenge is, though, sometimes those people are told, hey, you need thyroid hormone. And the really important distinction is, unless the gland is not making enough TSH, or if the levels of TSH and T4 are in the normal ranges, then you know your thyroid gland is healthy and you don't need thyroid hormone. If the T3 is skewed, that tells you there's something else that's perturbing the function. And the problem is, they're looked at as the same question. And this is why, coming back to that meta-analysis, 37% of people could stop their hormone, maintain normal levels, and have no change in symptoms.
But is there still value in giving the hormone? Like, let's say you are making, let's say the TSH is within the normal range and the T4 is adequate. So you're making that, but for whatever reason, whatever stress, and maybe that stress is the SIBO or the CFO or mental stress or whatever, is there value in taking thyroid, active thyroid, because you are not making it, to just create a physiological dose of that in hopes that your body gets better at doing all the things, making...
That's a very logical question. It's what I used to think was, yes, there's been about 10 clinical trials that have isolated for this, and they've given people with, you know, what's known as sluggish thyroid, kind of that metabolic issue, thyroid hormone replacement therapy. And consistently across all those clinical trials, people do not see improvements either in thyroid-related symptoms or quality of life symptoms.
Even giving them T3.
And this is why I'm so passionate about sharing this message. Now, there's one other thing that makes this confusing, because when people are hypothyroid, when they're true hypothyroid, about half of those people feel better if you give them T4 plus T3. But it's still separate from the first question, is, are you truly hypothyroid? And we got to get that right, because if we give someone thyroid hormone who doesn't need it, like I just outlined with that 10 meta-analysis clinical trial, they don't improve. And then the real travesty is, some of these people are on hormone for 3, 5, 7 years before someone like me checks and says, gosh, you know, way back when you weren't actually hypothyroid. And for some people, what you'll see is their numbers never get normal. Their TSH or T4, their T3, it's always a little bit wonky, to use a very medical term. And that's usually demonstrative of someone who's on hormone who doesn't need it. And the body's just trying to say, like, stop giving me this. And it's trying to shunt it in different directions. And oftentimes, I say oftentimes, but sometimes those people have more fatigue and they have insomnia. Because the other part that this connects to is, thyroid hormone helps with metabolism of stress hormones. And so if you give someone too much thyroid hormone, you can actually reduce their stress hormones, and you need enough stress hormone to be able to function, right? If someone had no cortisol, they wouldn't be able to talk. They'd just be so zonked, right? So in some people, you know, again, the promise of the thyroid hormone helping them is actually making them worse, because you're kind of like forcing the body into a higher level of the hormone the body's actively trying to turn down.
Do you ever find that, because obviously you put a lot of weight in the TSH and free T4, do you test for the T3 and the reverse T3 also, or do you generally not? The reason I would ask is, like, my question would be, when you address the SIBO, CFO, have you made obvious progress of that, where, like, the GI systems are better? Do you see the ratio of T3 to reverse T3 or T3 in general get better?
Yes, and there's some research that has shown again, just using probiotics as a really simple example of a gut intervention, showing that people can have healthier levels of TSH and free T4 after a probiotic intervention. And even those people may need less thyroid hormone prescription, presumably because they're metabolizing it better and because they're absorbing it better. There's some evidence, there was one Polish study that found people with SIBO had slightly higher thyroid antibodies than healthy control. So it may also impact thyroid autoimmunity. And I should mention regarding thyroid autoimmunity, so this is Hashimoto's in most cases that will damage the thyroid gland through this autoimmune process and eventually cause hypothyroidism. If you look at trials that can lower thyroid antibodies, people have probably heard about vitamin D, selenium, and myo-inositol as maybe three of the biggest supplements that can help lower chiefly the TPO antibody, which is the main blood test for assessing this. On average, you'll see these vitamins, which I think are great, lower thyroid antibodies by about 200 points, the TPO specifically. There's been a few trials looking at red light therapy applied right to the throat, the thyroid gland, and establishing about a 600-point reduction in thyroid antibodies. So I think that's really exciting. There's, again, it's only maybe two or three studies, but the two or three that do exist are showing anywhere from 400 to 600 points of reduction in TPO.
That's crazy. And that's basically from just turning on energy production at the thyroid? Or
yeah, the red light therapy does a few things, but specifically in the mitochondria are in every cell, and they also, coming back to metabolism, regulate metabolism. That's why I was saying metabolism is regulated by a few different things, including thyroid hormone, but also mitochondria, which are the energy factories in every cell. In the mitochondria, we have this assembly line for ATP or for energy. There's complex 1, 2, 3, and 4. And at the end of the line, between complexes 3 and 4, there's this cytochrome C enzyme that the red light stimulates. And by doing that, it increases energy production on a cellular level. And then whatever the cells are trying to do or repair, so in this case, there's this autoimmunity that's probably because of excessive damage to the gland, and the gland just can't repair fast enough because, not to go too far afield, but one of the theories on what drives thyroid autoimmunity is the barrier between your thyroid gland and the throat and your bloodstream is leaky. And so as particles leak out, the immune system goes, oh, we know we don't want that in the bloodstream, and it starts attacking. So if we can increase the health of the thyroid gland, allow it to repair better, seal that barrier, we can turn down the autoimmune process. And I think that's what's happening with the red light. The red light is optimizing mitochondria. Mitochondria are needed for cellular energy, and then all the functions, including repair and hormone production, are facilitated when you have adequate energy.
That's interesting. Yeah, I heard you talk about that recently, and I am one of those people that have spoiled myself with an overpriced red light.
And oh, no.
Which, if I could do it again, I wouldn't have bought the one I did, but I was in a bad way at the time and just was throwing money at trying to help myself. But I've been doing that. So I've used it off and on. I don't use it much in the summer because I get a lot of sun, but as the sun's been coming up later, I've been using the red light more. And then I heard that recent episode of yours, and now I'm putting my thyroid right up close to that thing, and I'm like massaging it, and I'm curious. Have you had any clients in the clinic like test that out? Have you had any kind of before and after yet with the red light?
We don't have enough afters yet because I only came across this boy maybe 2 months ago, but we now have a protocol that we're sending to patients, and you know, we should be getting some people following up. And I'm very curious to see if in the real world, you know, we see a reinforcement of what's been reflected in the studies. But I should also mention that some of those studies had a very important study design in that one group would do vitamin D and selenium. The other group would do vitamin D, selenium, plus red light, which is way more of a real world approximation, right? Because most people who have Hashimoto's or thyroid autoimmunity are probably on or have been on vitamin D and selenium. So looking at, do you have additional benefit when you're taking those vitamins if you add red light? And the answer is yes, right? It'd be different if there was just like the vitamin D and selenium in one arm and the red light in another, because then it's not an apple-to-apple comparison.
And the selenium there, I think I understand. The selenium people use because that's involved with the conversion of T4 to T3?
And it's an antioxidant, right? So it can help buffer some of that inflammation in the thyroid gland.
And then what's the vitamin D's role in that? Like, why does someone that has the autoimmunity...
Yeah, vitamin D modulates some of your T cell mediated immunity, specifically Treg. And Treg sort of sits upstream to this. It's known as a Th1, Th2 balance of the immune system. It's two arms. And Treg sort of sits atop of that bifurcation point and helps regulate or balance the immune system.
That went a little above my head, but I trust you. Where else I want to go?
Well, you know, but really quick on that, much more important to me is, are there clinical trials that give half the group a placebo, half the group vitamin D, showing that vitamin D lowers TPO antibodies? Because that's really where the rubber meets the road.
How do you give a placebo with red light?
You give them a light that has a red color to it, but it's not actually therapeutic red light. So think of like a little child's toy that's just like a red light.
Right.
But people aren't going to know because they're going to have something that looks like this probably in both groups. And the researcher comes up and holds it there for a minute or whatever it is. You do the same thing in a lot of trials that are photobiomodulation. You have a light that's the color. It might be blue. It might be pink. But it's not therapeutic. It's just like an LED light that you could have. Like right now, I have Halloween decorations up and my LED light, you know, can shine all different. It can shine green or blue or red. So it's sort of that kind of light.
But what would make it therapeutic? Is it the specific frequency? Because what if it's red visually? It's within the red range. Is it just like how much power?
Yeah, it's the irradiation. It's irradiance, the power, and then the wavelength. Most of the studies, if I'm recalling correctly, for thyroid, they were using between 800 and 850 nanometers. And then many of the red light devices will actually cover from about 600 to about 1200 regarding the wavelength. And I think that's actually better because you'll have, at least purportedly, you might have a sweet spot for different functions, like skin health might be at a slightly different point on that spectrum of infrared to near infrared. So it's probably the wavelength and the amplitude that needs to be really dialed in as compared to something like an LED light.
But the sun gives off all these, right? Like, can't you in theory just go out and, like, everybody has experienced, you go out, you've been inside all day and it's sunny and you feel some energetic boost.
100%. I think, and this is something I spoke at the Ancestral Health Symposium, I think it was around 2018, all about sun exposure and how we can't replicate with vitamin D supplementation all of the health benefits from the sun. So totally with you. I think we want to be getting sun exposure on most days, if not every day, for maybe 10 or 15 minutes at least, depending on if it's really hot and it's midday. You might cap out at 20 minutes or so because there is an upper limit at which you're going to start causing problems, right? I look at, as a partial pagan myself, I get it. The most important factor with sun is burning. The researchers, I think, who have concluded the following have it the most correct, which is chronic non-burning sun exposure is the best strategy for your health. The problem can be when you burn, every time you burn, the incidence of certain types of skin cancer goes up. But I'm with you, right? Where I think we're better off being in the sun than avoiding the sun. And I would certainly say if every time someone goes outside, they're slathered in sunscreen and they're wearing a hat, you're missing a really valuable opportunity.
I grew up getting burned all the time. And I haven't been burned in so long. I get more sun now than I ever did. And I don't know what's going on. I've heard a theory about different types of fats that you eat and how the polyunsaturated fats are, which I grew up on, standard American diet, are more unstable when it has the spark. So they don't necessarily like cause inflammation, but they make you more vulnerable to it. And the sun is that spark. But I get more sun now than I ever have. And it seems like I cannot get a burn if I want to. And I don't know if it's because of the dietary changes or just something else changing with my age, but it's been at the very least interesting.
Well, this is also something that you see in the literature, which is if people are doing kind of the weekend warrior approach with sun exposure, where they're not getting any sun on a regular basis, and then they're out for like 7 hours. And the same thing with exercise, you know, if you're just a weekend warrior, your injury likelihood goes up. But if you're doing regular chronic regular sun exposure, you condition your skin to better be able to tolerate the sun. I think that's probably the most key aspect. We're working on a piece, I might actually be recording this as soon as tomorrow, on seed oils, on the linoleic acid and sort of the omega-6. This is something I've changed my opinion on, where I used to make the claim, not to go too far afield, feel free to pull me back at any point if you want, if you don't want to go too deep on to seed oils, But I used to think that omega-6s were bad. They were inflammatory. In fact, I gave a lecture many years ago about how excessive omega-6 or the linoleic acid therein can feed the arachidonic acid pathway, which is inflammatory. That feeds the COX inflammatory pathway, which Advil blocks. So if anyone's ever used Advil for a headache or some sort of like shoulder pain, you're blocking the COX enzyme, which is fed by arachidonic acid, which is fed by linoleic acid or omega-6. And also that, as you pointed out correctly, that due to the fact that there's some double bonds in the linoleic acid, those are more, or there's less double bonds rather, those are more prone to oxidation. So that's been the theory, but there's been a number of papers that have actually tested these hypotheses. And when controlling for other confounders, so age, sex, smoking status, diet quality, trans fat consumption, when controlling for all those things, increasing omega-6 in the diet did not lead to any increase in oxidative measures, inflammatory measures, or arachidonic acid, or heart disease. In fact, something I learned that was really shifting and sort of cathartic for me was, if one of the reasons why omega-6 is bad is because it feeds this arachidonic acid inflammatory pathway, then, or I should add, when tracer studies have been done, they've actually shown that 1% or less of omega-6 is converted into arachidonic acid. So in theory, it sounds really bad, and you can draw out the pathways to show these pathways connect. Omega-6 feeds arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid feeds inflammation. But it's the effect. It's a magnitude of the effect, or what's known as the effect size. It's very, very small in terms of how much you influence, 1% or less, the arachidonic acid pathway. And I think Bill Harris has this the most correct, where he says, it's not about removing omega-6, linoleic acid, or seed oils. It's about making sure you have adequate omega-3. It's the omega-3 deficiency that's more important, and it's not necessarily the ratio of the two, because the body tightly regulates how much omega-6 is converted down that inflammatory pathway. And I know it's contentious. I used to think the opposite, but when we really drill down into this, looking at rigorous trials that take out processed food with seed oils and the trans fats therein and all the confounding variables, you actually see that a moderate consumption of seed oils or omega-6 doesn't seem to correlate with inflammatory markers, higher arachidonic acid, or heart disease.
That's interesting. Do you know how long those studies are?
There's been about 30 of them, and they range in different durations. I will tell you, from the BMC, there was one study that tracked on one line linoleic acid consumption, and on the other line heart disease. And what you see is in 19, about 11, when Crisco, which was a hydrogenated trans fat seed oil, was added to the food supply, the lines of heart disease and linoleic acid consumption are parallel. But in about the 1990s, when we started to get rid of trans fat and also reduce smoking, you see linoleic acid consumption continues to go up, omega-6 continues to go up, but heart disease starts to drop.
But is that also because people are dying earlier of other things now too, like cancers? And I get so confused when I look at studies. I was on for several years, I was on the Institutional Review Board for the Maryland University of Integrated Health. And I was so every IRB needs like some schmuck from the community that's not a scientist, that's not a researcher, that's not invested. No. They need somebody that is supposed to represent the community to keep the scientists in check. So they're not just like playing with people to get them. And a couple things I realized during that process is it's really hard to do good research. Like, it's really expensive. A lot of the things, it's very easy to theorize the perfect study, like from a third grade scientific method model, but it's near impossible to carry out the ideal study. And I don't know, like, I've seen so many studies where the data set is constant. The interpretation can be absolutely polar opposites by people that are very well educated. And I'm like, I don't know what to do with that.
Fully. There's been a point of frustration for me too, where you'll read the abstract, right? And the abstract will say X is bad. Then you read the data and you go, how are you coming to that conclusion based upon your data, right? So I totally get it. But this, again, I think is why it's important to look at the entire body of research, because there are two studies. It's the Sydney Heart Study and the Minnesota Coronary Study that found some deleterious effect from increasing omega-6 or seed oil consumption. But they had a really poor ability to factor out confounders, which I think is the main thing that you're calling out, which is so important, right? If people smoke, if they are overweight, if they are sedentary, we have to factor all that into the analysis so that we're trying to get the most representative. We're going to look at just people who exercise and don't smoke, and then the people who smoke and consume oils, right? So you have the most apple-to-apple comparison. There's never going to be a perfect study, but this is part of why I think it's so important to look at the randomized control trials that have done their best. You're never going to get perfect, but to reduce these confounding variables. Because if a well-designed study, and in this case, there's about at least 10 that are really well, I think, controlled for, where, again, to your point, we're never going to get the noise in the read down to zero, but we're going to try to get it to maybe 10%, right? It's to an acceptable level of confounding or of noise. If those studies aren't good enough, then we really come to, well, whatever I think is what I'm going to believe, or whomever makes the most convincing argument based upon mechanism is going to win the conversation. And I think that's part of how we get into a contentious landscape. And I see this, especially with seed oils. People repeatedly cite the couple of studies that found a deleterious effect, and they ignore the 10 or some odd that have not found a deleterious effect. I don't really care about seed oils. I don't really consume seed oils myself. I don't think they must be included into the diet, but I think they're one of the many things, like salt was vilified, like fat was vilified, like protein was vilified. And I would guarantee you in about 5 years, there's not going to be such vitriol against seed oils. And really what it comes down to, But what I think it comes down to is people are conflating it, as often happens, with processed food. And so I would agree, right? Trans or hydrogenated seed oils, bad. Processed food, bad. But with something like a safflower oil, a tablespoon per day, would that be a big deal? It doesn't seem to be.
I don't know. I just wonder, like, are there studies that say there's no big effect and they're 4 months long, but you need a 4-year study? I don't, who knows?
I believe some of them have gone as long or over a year. That's actually a really important question for me to circle back to as we've kind of been going through the analysis.
Like when I go out to, like I eat super clean 9 times, and when I go to a restaurant, I try to order clean. Like I'll order a simple food. But then they'll cook it in an oil that obviously is not what I'm cooking in. It'll be some type of seed oil, and I don't feel good. And maybe it's placebo, but like I have so many reps of that experience where it's like I ordered as clean as I could, and why do I feel like crap afterwards? And like it's the only thing I could find to point to. And I'm sure there's individual variability on how you're affected also. So you could have a lot of people that could tolerate it probably just fine, or maybe it makes them die at 85 instead of 90, and some people it makes you feel shit for like 3 days after one serving.
Well, here's something that we're currently looking into, because this is a question I've wondered. I believe that use of any hydrogenated or trans fat is regulated out of the U.S. food supply, but I don't know that for a fact, right? Because my parents were visiting recently, and they bought some Peter Pan peanut butter, and there was hydrogenated trans vegetable oil in the peanut butter. So the thing we're currently researching is, if regulation does not allow those to be put into the U.S. food supply, does that mean that Peter Pan is importing it from another country where they don't have those rules to skirt it? And can kitchens do the same thing, right? Can kitchens buy trans fats and cook in those? And is that where some of the problem is coming from? And then the other is, how many times are they reheating the oils? But I also think, even if it's olive oil, let's say, or avocado oil, they do have smoke points of about 400 degrees. And I would think even with those oils, if they're reusing them, and they also, if the kitchen's not clean, that's where I think some of your experience might be coming from. But I get it, right? But it also, it's different to say when you're eating out as compared to eating at home. And this is like where the conflation occurs, right? Because I would argue and there's a decent body of research that has found this, that the more you eat out, the unhealthier you are, right? So I don't think eating out, I'm not saying not to do it, right? Because I'll go out and I think a nice dinner with a glass of wine or whatever is great. But I think the food quality is usually pretty low. I question how clean certain kitchens are kept, how fresh their ingredients are, and then how much they're sort of heating and reheating some of the oils. But that reheating would be a problem even for most other oils that are non-seed oils. Coconut's going to have more resistance, sure. Fryer is the primary concern that I have. And then I wonder just, you know, if there's like one of those, I don't know what the name is called, but it's the big stovetop. I wonder if, you know, they're just keeping oils on there and they're not really cleaning it off thoroughly. And so you just have that residual oil from the last batch of food that was cooked that's being reheated. But, you know, nevertheless, the big thing is that I'm just trying to give people what I feel to be a reasonable run through of the research on seed oils so that people don't become neurotic, right? Like if they go out to a restaurant, I had this experience with a friend, he was grilling the waiter about seed oils. And I don't know if they're so deleterious where you have to be sort of encroaching on your social experience every time you go out to eat. So if nothing else, I just want to give people hey, there's a sliver of this you can include in your diet without any health ramifications, which is totally different than saying putting a bunch of trans fat seed oils in processed food is okay. And that's the thing that can be kind of tricky to disentangle.
So the most important thing is like, listen to your body. I mean, people get really disconnected. Like if food is nourishing, it should feel nourishing. And if it feels like you feel like crap after it, that's worth listening to and not ignoring.
Well, that's what we say at the clinic. We say at the clinic, you know, your body is boss, meaning all of these changes at the clinic that we recommend with diets or supplements, it's all hypothesis until the person reports back and says, I feel better, I feel the same, or I feel worse, right? That's the ultimate, at least as a clinician, barometer that we're using. Are these things working? Is your health improving?
Right. Speaking of the barometer, I have one other question about the thyroid. I wanted to ask your opinion and then maybe finish up with you could talk about the clinic a little bit. I've listened to a lot of people talk about the work of, I think it's Dr. Broda Barnes from back in the day, who treated a lot of people with natural desiccated thyroid, maybe iodine too. I don't know if I've heard that part, but using body temperature as a really important barometer to just judge how someone's thyroid is working, with the idea of, you know, our metabolism is making energy out of foodstuff, and a byproduct of that is making heat, and that is a useful barometer of what your current metabolic state is. Do you ever have any experience using the body temperature?
I don't, and this is because when we reviewed the literature on this, you see that, ironically, thyroid has a few nuanced exceptions, but symptoms are not very predictive of hypothyroidism. Actually, the most predictive way is to run a thyroid blood test.
What if somebody has good blood numbers, but they have a lot of like typical low thyroid symptoms?
This is what we published. We published two papers in 2022 on this, because it was just so common that we were seeing people who felt like they were force-fed thyroid hormone. And, you know, we published in the journal Nutrients, which is a pretty prestigious journal. I mean, it's not, you know, the journal of the American Medical Association, but Nutrients is a very credible journal. And we published a 6-part case series where people came in and they had been on all sorts of different thyroid hormone cocktails. And then we even tried further still modulating, right? Desiccated thyroid or a separate T4 and T3 and then upping the T3. And people just weren't getting any better until we did two things. One, get people off of thyroid hormone who weren't true hypothyroid, or if they were hypothyroid, just kind of leave the thyroid alone and focus on their gut health. And this is why we published this case series, because it was so common that people would have thyroid-like symptoms and they would miss the fact that their gut was actually the preceding factor leading to their symptoms. And the challenge with thyroid symptoms is they're so nonspecific. Fatigue, many things can cause fatigue, as I know you know. Constipation, dry skin, brain fog, those permeate mitochondrial dysfunction, mold, Lyme, SIBO, SIFO, IBD, IBS, right? So, and this is why I'm so passionate about this message, coming back to that one in three people on thyroid hormone who don't need it. We want to go through that evaluation. If you're hypothyroid, get someone on medication, and about half those people, per Barnes and others, will prefer some sort of desiccated combo of T4 and T3, yes. But if after that, someone's still floundering, I think it's a huge mistake to keep tinkering and tinkering and tinkering with their levels, because the problem might actually be their gut. And that's what we published that case series on, is all the people who were helped after having a little bit more of a holistic view on where their symptoms were coming from.
So no on the body temperature.
So in a roundabout way, no on the body temperature, because symptoms aren't highly correlated with if someone's hypothyroid or not.
But you're basing that on calling abnormal TSH and free T4 hypothyroid, where some people might look at hypothyroid is when your metabolism is not functioning optimally.
Yes, but that's definitionally, that's not hypothyroid, because there's many things that can perturb metabolism, right? If you weren't sleeping well and you had high free T3, it would be egregiously incorrect for me to tell you you're hypothyroid. And that's kind of the point that I'm making, is this happens so much, and there are so many people who have been on thyroid medication for years. I mean, remember that thyroid hormone is lifelong. So there's been so many people we've seen who've been told you need thyroid hormone in perpetuity, and the problem wasn't even their thyroid gland, because probably compassionately, the clinician was saying, well, this is a little off, so let's give you thyroid hormone. And the case that we're trying to make is we're too quickly jumping to thyroid, and we're oftentimes overlooking the gut. And if nothing else, we just want doctors and patients to have a broader view, so you don't miss what might be driving your symptoms because you're kind of tunnel visioned into the thyroid. They all have their time and their place.
So in general, like my overarching question today was really that chicken or egg thing. So you think it's generally more useful to try to just get the gut functioning better, do the things, the interventions that are hopefully inexpensive, that make it inviting to do those interventions to reduce the symptoms in the gut, and then see how that affects thyroid and or, you know, any potential dysfunction in metabolism. You feel like it's more sensitive to go that first, because that could be the very thing drawing the metabolism down.
Yes, we call it the diet, lifestyle, and gut health foundation. Now, that being said, you know, we can also screen for hypothyroidism at the same time. And some of this is super practical. Is there a family history, right? Was your mom or your dad, or maybe your mom and your grandmother hypothyroid? That's, you know, one thing to look at. Do you have a blood panel? What did that blood panel look like? Was your TSH a 4? Then, you know, you're not hypothyroid. But maybe your TSH was an 11 and your TPO is really high. Okay, so now this person needs hormone. The point I'm trying to make is it's not difficult to disentangle this. It just requires a paradigm that's not going to blame thyroid for all the symptoms. Because ultimately, if we don't treat what's driving the symptoms, then people don't get better. And that's, I think, what we're all after, is just feeling well as quickly as possible.
But we're also, as you get older, you just get worse at everything, unfortunately, as I'm experiencing. And like, we're supposed to be making thyroid. Does that naturally just get worse as you get older? So the idea of having to take something forever, like, I take some vitamins and minerals, and I don't get upset at the idea. I'm grateful that I get to take them forever. Like, I'm grateful that I will have the opportunity to. I don't necessarily think that's inherently bad that you have to take something forever. If it was like something your body doesn't make, and it was like, I don't think people have like heart disease because of, I don't know, statin deficiency. Not that there's not a place for them, whatever. So like, when I look at thyroid and I think, considering the stressful world we live in and all the things that could be dampening our metabolism, because you could do all the things right, but you still could live in like really toxic environment and whatever, stressful job. Like I could see how that's a tough uphill battle maybe to get over. And if your gut health is, you know, if you try to address that, I wonder if the TSH or the T4 doesn't tell the whole story, and symptoms do matter. Like, how many people, if they just had thyroid, the amount that their body should make, but they don't because they're 50 or 60 or 70, would they just feel better from that replacement.
I mean, and again, you know, this is where I used to be of that camp. And then day after day, year after year, looking at how this plays out, people don't really seem to improve when you do that. And like I said before, there's been about 10 randomized control trials that have tried this, that have said, well, you know, maybe if the thyroid's a little bit sluggish and we give people hormone, they're going to improve. And, you know, again, the 10 trials that have examined this have consistently found that they don't feel better. I leave a crack in the door if someone wants to do an anti-aging approach where they're going to go on a low dose of thyroid, a low dose of testosterone, a low dose of estrogen and progesterone. But, you know, again, if we're going to use science to inform and sort of change our views, as I've changed my view, it's because the sort of like standard opinion in this field of healthcare is very liberal with the use of thyroid hormone. And I was doing that for a while, and we were doing that for a while, and we just didn't see it consistently improve how people feel. But I do think, to your point, there's a strong case to be made for sex hormone support, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. Women are lucky because there are some herbs that work phenomenally well for female hormones like Dong Quai, Black Cohosh, and Chase Tree, aka Vitex. In fact, we did a podcast with Dr. Antonio Bianco, who is the former head of the American Thyroid Association. He's an endocrinologist. He's published some of the papers that have found people do better on desiccated than on just T4 alone. The reason why I think this podcast has over, I think it's over 120,000 views, is because people are starved for a responsible perspective on this. The extremes are conventional medicine says, no, you don't have a problem, just, you know, just levothyroxine, that's all. TPO doesn't matter, vitamin D doesn't matter, selenium doesn't matter, your diet doesn't matter. Okay, I would say that's missing a ton. Functional medicine, almost everyone with symptoms needs thyroid. Everyone's got to be gluten-free and on a gazillion supplements. I think that's also wrong. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. And one of the things that, it's funny, Bianco kind of lit up like a Christmas tree when I mentioned that in the clinic, we see a number of women who are being given thyroid hormone when the symptoms are clearly coming from female hormone imbalances. And he said, oh, yeah, he got really animated because he was seeing the same exact thing. So I don't mean to keep kind of pushing back on the thyroid piece. I do think there's people who clearly need it, but there are more people, I think, who are being underserved because their gut or their female hormones, or maybe for men, their testosterone, are being overlooked. And it's just too quickly a reflex of thyroid hormone.
Gotcha. My gut from that goes to, not to beat the dead horse, but like, isn't thyroid what's modulating the conversion of cholesterol into those downstream products, such as those hormones? Like, you're making, I'm going to get this wrong, pregnenolone first. I think it turns into, and then it works its way down into those other hormones.
The desmolase enzyme converts cholesterol into pregnenolone, and then on the other side, DHEA. Yeah.
So like, if thyroid was functioning optimally, like putting aside a blood value, if it was functioning optimally, wouldn't it be able to make those hormones that they're now trying to modulate with?
I would argue it's far too simplistic of a view, right? It's, again, like I was saying before, it's the tunnel vision of everything comes back to thyroid. What about the woman who has irregular cycles, heavy bleeding, and really frank PMS? And there, you know, there are other things. If your posit was true, because all these things I think are worthwhile hypotheses to put on the board and study, but the point I keep coming back to is there have been over 1,000 patients where this experiment has been run and they haven't improved in terms of how they're feeling. So if we're optimizing for like a theoretical biochemical pathway, you can do whatever you want. And I think that's part of the problem, is that when people just theorize from the mechanism, without, because that's a starting point. Yes, agree, right? But then we have to take that over to the lab, so to speak, and test it in free living humans and see what moves the needle. And again, there are some people who clearly need the thyroid care and support, but there's many people who are having more important things missed, like their female hormones. And in some people, it's just, you know, what's going to break down? For some women, the weaker point might be their female hormones as compared to their thyroid.
Yeah, everybody's so different. And, you know, everybody's dealing with their own set of variables in their environment and their life situation that could, you know, change how their genes are being expressed at that time.
Yeah, and that's what I care about, right? What I care about is not being married to a certain cause of symptoms, but sort of having a broader perspective of, okay, mitochondria, thyroid, chronic infections, gut health, dietary issues, psycho-spiritual issues, relationship with food. And you have this mosaic you look at when you're getting to know a new person and you pursue what seems to be the most supported, rather than just thinking, you know, well, everyone's got to be on thyroid, or everyone's got to be on a probiotic, or everyone's got to be on, you know, whatever it is.
Speaking of probiotic, for listeners, Ruscio puts out a great probiotic if you want one. Little plug there for you. Thank you for taking all this time. Now, you have a clinic and you actually see people. I want to at least give you a few minutes. I know we're running over. I apologize, but I want to give you the chance to talk about what you do at your clinic.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, working with people has been the biggest teacher, right? Like, I don't think I'll ever stop working with people, because there's all these theories that when you test them, you get a sense for, okay, this theory works for these people, but it doesn't work for those people. And that theory works for those people, but not these other people. So, you know, to all the people that have worked with me or the other doctors in the clinic, thank you, because you've been such a massive teacher for us. And we try to be really responsible with that in terms of always studying and learning and questioning any belief or hypothesis that we have. Because also, when you learn about something new, it's really easy to just be so jazzed. Right? We were recently learning about hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and all the doctors, oh my God, this is going to help everybody. And it's like, all right, let's pull back, because this is probably not as good as we think it is. And it's like a cycle you go through. You're really excited about thyroid, mitochondria, gut, whatever it is. And then you find a more balanced perspective. But, you know, at the clinic, we see people in a telehealth model. We perform and publish research and just love what we do. Right? I've had health issues. Some of our other clinicians have also had health issues. And like you said, the wound is the gift. It's been a huge gift, because it's allowed us to be inside of the healthcare system as a patient, and also on the other end as a clinician. So if anyone is in need of help, maybe they want to double check their thyroid diagnosis or their gut health and not spend thousands of dollars on testing, you know, we're more than happy to help however we can.
That's great. And for the listeners, if you haven't checked it out, Dr. Ruscio's book, Healthy Gut, Healthy You, is an outstanding resource, and also makes for a great gift for anyone you know that is having some gut issues and doesn't want to take a big jump, but just wants to maybe learn a little something. It's a very easy read and get a lot of good insights. Dr. Ruscio, thanks for putting up with me. I feel like I was pushing back there. I'm very curious also, and I feel like I could, you know, I want 10 hours with you and I don't have it. So thank you for the back and forth there. I really do appreciate your open-mindedness, and I will continue to use your weekly podcast. Is just a fantastic, it's like one of my absolute go-tos. It's like, there's only a couple podcasts I listen to that are really health related, and yours has been a staple for several years now. So I really appreciate it and really encourage people to check it out. And the name of that is it just the Dr. Ruscio podcast? What is that?
Dr. Ruscio Radio. You can search my name. Yeah, it's on the podcast directories and also in YouTube. And thank you. I think the pushback is really helpful, because these are all questions that people are going to hear or have, or they're questions that I had at one point. And I try to offer the best answers I can, you know, wherever I can.
Well, again, I really appreciate the way you go about it. For the listeners, always grateful for your listening. I hope you got something out of this, and please share the episode if you know someone that you think would be interested. Have a great day, everyone.